I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. It's no secret now that race played a part in how men like J.C. Nichols planned Kansas City, but the effects of those age-old practices are still felt. Today we get an urban designer's take on how the shape of our city affected its black residents, hemmed in for decades by racist covenants and redlining. Then you recall Khizr Khan. He's the Gold Star father from last year's Democratic National Convention who held up a pocket edition of the Constitution and challenged Donald Trump to read it. We'll talk with Khan about his life, his family, and about what his adopted country means to him. Later, this week's Local Listen. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. For the past 5 years, architect Tyler Cucar has been trying to answer a very specific set of questions pertaining to Kansas City. How did race shape the city, and how did those long-lasting effects wind up affecting African Americans? They are provocative questions, and Tyler is well-suited to answer them. He grew up in the suburbs here, and today is an urban designer based in New York City working for FX Fowl Architects. And Tyler, welcome.
Yeah,
welcome home.
Yeah, great to be here.
Yeah. What got you started on this idea of how race shaped Kansas City?
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting question as how I got here. You know, growing up in the suburbs of Kansas City, I then went to school in Arkansas, a very different environment.
Yes.
And when I went to Arkansas, I realized I was actually from a city, but grew up in the suburbs, and this whole relationship started to build. So I became very interested in how the suburbs of America became the way they are. And
right.
There was a lot of conversation around that. And that's when I really started to discover the role race had in instigating the suburbs, thus creating the city and urban environment that we're left with today. And that kind of, once you're made aware of that situation, it really propelled me down this line of research and thought and questioning.
You could have investigated any major American city, but you chose this one. Why?
Sure. Well, obviously a little biased, the hometown flavor, but you know, there is research done on this to most major American cities and a plethora of it for New York City specifically. But Kansas City really is a prototypical American city in terms of its size, its history, its development, its racial makeup.
Right.
But we're still one of the most segregated cities in America to this day. And we have some cultural touchstones that have lasted from the early years of segregation, from jazz, barbecue, the Country Club Plaza, not all directly from racial decisions, but secondary and tertiary results of these racial policies.
You know, we hear all the time that Kansas City is one of the most segregated towns in America. Is there any way to sort of scientifically measure that? Do we know for a fact that that's the case? Not that I doubt it, but I'm just wondering.
There are. There's equality indexes and a lot of analysis that can be done through mapping and demographics, housing levels, income levels, I think the study shows right now we're the 9th most segregated.
Huh.
And tonight at the event at the Center for Architecture, there will be some guests, Kate Collignon from HRNA and Gwen Grant of the Urban League of Kansas
Sure.
City, who bring a lot of this scientific data to illustrate this point.
I'm just curious now, what's the most segregated city in America?
It does tend towards St. Louis is very high up there. Detroit was there. It's changing now. That's the things a lot of cities are actively trying to address this. And so it's in flux and changing.
Can you change it? Once you're designated as segregated and you are segregated, can you reverse that somehow?
You know, I think that is the question right now as to how to do this. Because in a lot of cases, a lot of the decisions cities are making to revitalize their cities and bring life back to them, if you will, is only exacerbating the problem and just pushing the segregation line to a different part of the city, in many cases pushing what was low-income black communities to the suburbs, which is an entirely different problem and one that's much worse than having them located in the center city.
Meaning that good-thinking people are trying to solve this, but they're making the problem worse?
To some degree, yeah, correct. And it's a problem is it's a lot of trial and error. We're still in the middle of realizing the problem and attempting to rectify and correct it. And so we're learning lessons as we go and saying, okay, that didn't work or had some unintended consequences. So right. how can we shift it and try it again differently?
That's interesting. Well, translate this for us here, Tyler, because when you talk about race shaping this city, you're talking about what exactly?
Yeah, you know, in my research, I've kind of broken it down into five kind of periods that shaped the physical environment we see. You know, from the beginning, post-Civil War to the early 1900s, was a lot of just market and social forces that guided our growth. And then we come into the, you know, 19-teens, 1920s with racial covenances that started really placing Black and whites in the city where they would live, which was followed by federal policy, which was what we know now as redlining, which federally said what neighborhoods could receive investment.
Yeah.
And those boundaries were generally followed by urban renewal and infrastructure projects. So these lines have been repeated and embedded into our city legally and physically to this day. And, you know, 71 South and Troost are really the physical manifestations of these divides.
We're talking about how race has shaped the development of Kansas City. Have we always been as segregated as we are now?
In recent times, we have, you know, following the Civil War, 1865 through about 1908, we lived mostly integrated. There were enclaves of Blacks next to Italians and Jews, and it was very mixed at the time. It wasn't until 1908, 1910, the early 20s, that it really began to start being constricted or controlled or orchestrated, as I like to call it.
And that's an amazing thing in and of itself, that we were once in a different place, and then very deliberately, it sounds like, we became something else.
Right. It's interesting, because it wasn't the masses at the time that were wanting this. It was select individuals that had had goals, and many times they weren't explicitly, I want to be racist, for lack of a better term, but they had, in Kansas City, it was a lot of the upper-class white elites who were wanting to develop neighborhoods for themselves and people like them and maintain property value. Mm-hmm. And racial homogeneity was, at the time, a way to maintain property value. They thought remaining in your race was the best way to do this.
One name I've written a lot about, and I think you're referring to him now, is J.C. Nichols, mm-hmm. the developer of the Plaza. He certainly is a key figure here.
He is very much a key figure and talked about greatly. And he's well known at the Urban Land Institute and has awards named for him and his radical rethinking of land use and land subdivision. But he also rethought how we use deed restrictions. Mm-hmm. You know, those were originally tied to a building and lasted 10 to 20 years. He tied them to pieces of lands and had them last for 25 years at self-renewing. So they basically never ended. And he slipped in this racial line saying they could never be occupied or owned by Blacks.
If our listeners want to join our conversation here with questions for Tyler Cukor about how race affected the development of Kansas City, 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Again, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. And I should say that Tyler is going to be speaking about this issue tonight in a talk titled Orchestrated Urbanism, the Race-Built City. It's being presented by the Center for Architecture and Design. Downtown. The event is sold out, but you can add your name to a wait list by going to cfadkc.org. C, F as in Frank, A as in Apple, D as in Dog, KC.org to get on a wait list for tonight. So bottom line this for us, Tyler, how big a factor has race been and how this city has been shaped over the decades?
I think it's critical and it's a major factor that many people aren't aware of. It's a general understanding that segregation happened, but there's this thought that it was just, I say just lightly, but it was just housing and where people could live, mm-hmm. not understanding the economic, the job opportunity impacts, the education impacts, and really the mental impacts of being visually and physically separated from thriving parts of the city, like the east side in Kansas
City. Expand that a little bit. When you say jobs and education, what are you talking about?
Sure. Well, obviously with school segregation and integration is a huge component in the redrawing of lines. And even when schools were integrated, there was predatory real estate agents who would what we know as white flight and use fear tactics to get whites out of black neighborhoods. So though the schools were integrated, they really weren't. Mm-hmm. And the tax base wasn't there to support a good public school system and to get the best teachers. Those were fleeing out to the growing city and the expanding city limits. So mm-hmm. if education isn't there, job opportunities are, of course, going to be limited and generally weren't located in these communities. They're mm-hmm. located in other parts of the city, the Central Business District, which is near transportation and access for those coming from the suburbs.
So you can't help but wonder then, and one of the things you've looked at, Tyler, is the impact on African Americans over the decades. What did you come up with?
Yeah, I mean, they're at a point now where their income levels are so drastically lower than white Americans and even Hispanics in the city, that they're at an unequal it's an unequal playing field. And that's mm-hmm. something I talk about in the writing and tonight is the difference between equality and equity. Mm-hmm. They're at such a disadvantage financially, educationally, that even if we provide equal opportunity to achieve or have access to a plethora of things, they don't have equal access to that equal opportunity. Mm-hmm. And fixing that, again, it's bigger than architecture and urban design and physical environment. It's all of these pieces having to play together and recognize the issue to solve it.
And to be clear, this legacy of redlining, this legacy of racial covenants, these disadvantages you're outlining here, they linger to this day?
They do. They do. The east side of Kansas City specifically, if you look at home values, educational attainment, upward mobility, they're able to progress professionally. And you look at generational poverty, the ability for the children to do better than their parents. And the east side of Kansas City lacks significantly in this realm.
That notion that these effects continue to this day, it seems to me, is a pretty important point.
It is. I think that's the point that I want to drive home with the research and the conversations is that this is still an issue today. It's this idea of post-racial society, and that it hasn't gone away, and these ramifications or these negative results have really compounded and built on each other to be the most serious at this point.
Architect Tyler Cuecar is my guest. We're talking about how race has influenced the development of Kansas City over so many decades. Again, our phone number here, 816-235-2888. You can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Murad from Harrisonville, good morning.
Good morning. I really appreciate the topic this morning. Thank you very much for having me on the air.
You bet.
The gentleman who's speaking, the speaker, and I miss your name, but it was told to me years ago by an older African-American woman that during the early 1900s, there was a practice that came from J.C. Nichols where realtors would go into communities and tell people that if they sold their properties to African-Americans, it would reduce the property value by 20%, but not just of their property, but for everyone's property in that subdivision or in that neighborhood. And also the idea that white flight began in Kansas City as a result of these rules that were in place.
I've done a lot of reading on this, and I think Murad's onto something here.
Yeah, absolutely. The term for that was blockbusting, going in and using these fear tactics to push white flight. So I always talk about the idea of white flight. The idea is marginally misleading, in my opinion. White flight gives this idea that white Americans just ran out of just sheer fear and racism. But in fact, they were given very little options if they wanted to own a single family home or if they wanted to have receive loans to repair their homes with the GI Bill. And with redlining, the FHA would not insure loans for homes in certain neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. So they would not, that's redlining, they would not insure loans.
So the federal government was complicit in this as well.
Correct. And it's hidden well because it doesn't explicitly say we won't loan to African Americans. It just says we won't loan for you to build in this neighborhood, which is 100% mm-hmm. African-American. And in the write-ups of the redlining maps, they explicitly say the main reason is because it's, you know, their language, it's a Negro district.
How blatant, you've mentioned the term racial covenants here that were signed to keep neighborhoods all white, for instance. How explicit were those covenants in demanding that no people of color could move into certain neighborhoods of the city?
And they were as explicit as they possibly could be. You'd go from one covenant saying you have to have a 20-foot setback on your front property, and the next line would say no ownership or occupation by Negroes. It was no, mm-hmm. it was no muddling, no gray. It was very clear.
And those were in effect for neighborhoods, what, in Brookside and Prairie Village and where else?
Yeah, all of J.C. Nichols' properties from the south of Brush Creek. Moving on, he started in 1907-08 with Sunset Hill, and it really just progressed from there.
Wow. 816-235-2888, how race has shaped Kansas City. That's our topic here. Let's go to Trevor from Kansas City, Missouri. Trevor, good morning. You're on with Tyler Cukar.
Great. Thank you so much for having me on. It seems to me that one of the strongest leftovers of this explicit racial divide that we've been talking about is the de facto segregation of our school districts. And I was wondering how important Tyler thinks doing a better job of integrating our school districts is to integrating the city as a whole.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's absolutely critical. But the question, it really becomes how do you do that? You know, and that's the problem with a lot of this topic is each piece is looked at in isolation. Let's fix housing. Let's fix jobs. Let's fix the schooling. But it's all tied together. So if mm-hmm. our school district is coming from taxes, the inner city can never get that tax base to get those kind of schools. And unless you're going to force mm-hmm. People to move or force whites to move to the inner city and blacks move out to the suburbs and busing, it becomes a real question of how do you make this happen? But it is critical.
You know, if you were able to wave your architectural magic wand here, do we know of one, two, or three steps we could take to make this a more integrated city and to end this reputation as Kansas City as being so racially segregated?
Sure. I mean, I wish I did.
Yeah.
I think a lot of cities do.
Are you aiming for that ultimately?
I would like to. I think I'm aiming for the way I present it is having awareness, advocacy, which is then followed by action.
Sure.
Because there isn't a one answer fits all, of course, and there's not an answer might work on one site, it might not work on another site.
Sure.
And architects, from my experience, the architecture of a building or design of a place can't change it by itself. It can certainly go a long way, creating good public space that promotes interaction and integration between different walks of life is great, but it really has to be involving all of the players, the planners, the community groups, the municipality, the landscape architects. Everyone has to be involved to make it work.
Let's go back to some phone calls here. Barbara from Midtown. Barbara, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. I wanted to ask the gentleman what in the world are people who have been living in the city for a long time? I'm an elderly white person. I've been in Kansas City, Midtown since 1977. It was a very mixed community when I moved here in this Longfellow neighborhood. And now, you know, people are just being priced out all over the place. I mean, nobody. Not only is the mixture less desirable now, in my opinion, but I don't know where we can go. All the development, is there anything in Kansas City's redesign plan to do anything like revitalization rather than regentrification? I don't know how in the world where I'm going to go.
Wow.
I can't afford the suburbs either, so that's not an option at this point.
Good question, the big question, Tyler.
Yeah, that is the big question. There's a lot of developments in Kansas City that, you know, Beacon Hill is one of them that is developing along truce and in these areas, but their target income level and their target resident is not actually the community. It's their target resident is 50% outside of Kansas City. Mm. So a lot of cities, including in New York City, we're looking at things called mandatory inclusionary housing, which is basically rezoning parts of the city and requiring developers to provide affordable housing. Mm-hmm. You know, we're beginning to do that in New York, and it can work, but we're seeing possible issues with, is this just pushing gentrification in some capacity? Because though it's providing affordable housing, it's changing the character of the neighborhood.
Alice from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Good morning. I wanted to make a comment that I live near Redbridge Terrace in a small division of that called Calico Farms. I was the first African-American on that street of Redbridge Terrace, and in, I think it was 1998 or 99, when the Homeowners Association decided to vote that covenant out, that I had the pleasure of being able to sign that it was no longer a covenant area.
And that was a big moment, I'm sure, Alice.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. Okay. Because, yes, covenant was something that, you know, I kind of knew about, but to experience it was different.
I bet. Well, Tyler, we're out of time, but I hope as you continue research, you come up with more findings, that you'll come back and visit with us, because this is an important conversation.
Absolutely.
Appreciate it very much.
Thanks a lot.
That's Tyler Cukor. Again, he's an architect from New York City with FX Fowl Architects. He speaks tonight at an event sponsored by the Center for Architecture and Design. The event is sold out. You want to get on a wait list, cfadkc.org. Okay, time for a break, and when we come back, we're going to change topics dramatically. We'll turn and visit with Khizr Khan, who lit up the Democratic National Convention last year. He'll be with us in just a moment. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Tomorrow, as the number of men facing sexual misconduct accusations grows, we ask the ethics professors if it's fair to paint all offenders with the same brush. And what do we owe the victims? That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, in the summer of 2016, Khizr Khan stood before the Democratic National Convention and lit up the hall. Here's a bit of what he said that night in Philadelphia.
Donald Trump, you're asking Americans to trust you with their future. Let me ask you, have you even read the United States Constitution? I will gladly lend you my copy.
Khizr Khan was at the convention as a Muslim American Gold Star father whose son, Captain Humayun Khan, was killed in Iraq in 2004. Captain Khan had stopped a taxi loaded with explosives at a checkpoint, stepping forward so that other soldiers in his command didn't have to. Khizr Khan has written a memoir about his life and what America means to him. That book, An American Family, A Memoir of Hope and Sacrifice. He joins us now from the studios of St. Louis Public Radio. Mr. Khan, welcome to the show.
Well, good morning. Thank you for inviting me.
You almost didn't make that speech at the Democratic convention. Why did you hesitate?
When the invitation came, I immediately asked our other two sons, should we go or shouldn't we go? We are private, humble, modest people, not familiar with the after effects and what it takes to be at such a public forum. That was the hesitation initially, and we were advised, do not go. Your reputation, your peace, your integrity, everything will be questioned and challenged. And by nature, the people that know us told us that this is not your cup of tea, so do not go. So we pondered for 2 days, should we go or shouldn't we go? And we sat in the room where Captain Humayun Khan's picture is hung on the wall. and just trying to get some sense. We are people of faith and some guidance. And we almost made the decision that we really should not go. But then one event made us go, and we explained that in the book.
You got a letter, right?
Yes, from what was taking place, that bigoted statement that was made earlier in December of 2015, we will ban all Muslims, all Hispanics will be thrown out because they are criminals. Judges are partial. Women don't deserve equal dignity. And so whenever we would go to various birthday parties of small children, our children, their neighbors, and small kids of elementary school, middle school, parents knew that I practice law, would reach out to me and would say, is this true? Our children are being bullied. And these are the children of all races, all color, all faith. And in school, children are being bullied by, they're being told, oh, you will be thrown out of here. So don't worry about studying or coming to school. And children don't sleep, don't eat well, don't want to go to school. So this was, and I would hearten them. I would read them the section 1 of the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, that we are equal, we are with equal protection, with the due process, and no, you will not be thrown out of here. And they would humbly ask, they would say, can we finish our elementary school? But we don't know where we will go because we were born here. Our parents are born here. We just look different. Is this the reason for us to be thrown out of here? So I would hearten them, and some children will be heartened and some will not, and they will still remain worried. So the second day I went to check the mail, and we almost decided what was kept us going, pondering should we go or shouldn't we go, was that question of these small children that had asked me. And we just did not have the heart to simply say, no, we really want to keep our peace and our quiet and our modesty at home. We don't want to be part of it. Their questions. So I go to check the mail second day in the afternoon, and I find a card in the mailbox, and it was written by 4 students. They put their names, name of the school on top of the card. And this was the sentence that sent us to that national convention and has continued, helped us continue speaking even today. And the sentence said, Mr. Khan, would you make sure that Maria is not thrown out of this country? We love her. She's our friend. Even today, the power of that sentence,
yes,
so innocently written on behalf of Maria, still keeps us going. So I brought that card immediately at home to Ghazala and showed it to her. I said, look, we've been praying. Some guidance should come. Here is the decision. And she looked at me with eyes welled and said, call them. We will go. And we went, and we have continued since then.
Author, lawyer, and 2016 Democratic National Convention star Keyser Khan is my guest. At the end of your speech, you urged all immigrants to not take the November election for granted. At the time you spoke, it appeared that Hillary Clinton was well on her way to the White House. Some might conclude that they did take the election for granted. And I'm wondering how frustrated you are as a result.
Well, majority of this country did not take it seriously, and they voted. And but we are, of course, disappointed, heartbroken, and disheartened. Not just for the sake of one candidate or the other, but for the values and the dignity and the status of this nation throughout the world and among ourselves. The division and the hatred of one another based on faiths and religions and race is a harmful notion that perverts in our nation today. I have spoken to 170 plus communities throughout the country. This nation is fully acknowledging the values of our founding documents, our declaration, our Constitution, our Bill of Rights, that unity is the solution. The hopefulness that this nation has is the solution to this division that exists, that is colored by the malice from overseas, from the foreign hands. So, yes, we are heartbroken, we are disappointed, but I am very hopeful these 170-plus speaking engagements throughout the world, throughout the country, by invitation of various organizations, religious, political, social, citizens organization, bar associations, have given me hope that this nation is fully realizing that the prosperity and the solution to the hatred, to this division, lies in our firm belief in our founding documents, in the dignities that are enshrined in our Bill of Rights. I purposefully call these values that are enshrined in our documents human dignities, that entire world aspires to have these dignities in their life. We are fortunate to have them guaranteed to us, and we must protect them. That was the mission of Captain Humayun Khan. He was so truthful to the oath of office that he took to protect others, to care for others. So,
I should point out that Keyser Khan will be talking about his memoir, An American Family, A Memoir of Hope and Sacrifice, at 7 o'clock tomorrow evening at Unity Temple on the Plaza. For information and tickets, go to rainydaybooks.com or call 913-384-3126. Mr. Khan, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about the news that's breaking today about the president facing fierce criticism again for retweeting three inflammatory videos from a British far-right account that's rife with anti-Muslim content. The videos depict purported Muslims assaulting people and, in one video, smashing a statue of the Virgin Mary. This action by the president is being labeled disturbing. It's being labeled as bizarre. I'm wondering what your take is on it.
It's very unfortunate as we reach the season of holidays where we ought to be celebrating one another, our faiths and neighborhoods and our citizenship, that this president continues to embarrass this nation. This nation is nation of human dignities enshrined in our basic founding documents that made this nation beacon of hope for the rest of the world. But this president is void of empathy, void of leadership and decency, that certain things, dignified office of the president's, should not be engaged in. But this president continues to embarrass the nation, continues to embarrass the office. We're I reluctantly say this, but I must say this in answer to your question, that I do not expect any better behavior from this president. This president is void of empathy. He's void of leading the nation towards unity. He has based his candidacy and his presidency on division, and division is harmful. Unity is powerful. In unity lies the solution to our difficulties. But that leadership will not come from him.
I want to go back to your new book, because it's something very different than what we're talking about here and right now. It's your story, and it's full of wonder. It's full of optimism about America and everything this country has represents. When you were a boy growing up in Pakistan, tell us about the first time you came across our Declaration of Independence.
I was 22 years old, 1972. Mm-hmm. I had taken a course in comparative study of world constitution and constitution of Soviet Union. Yes, Russia used to be Soviet Union, and constitution of Germany and Magna Carta, the British foundation of their legal system. And then, of course, our blessed three documents, Declaration of Independence, Bill of Rights, and our articles. The very first page of those materials, when I brought them from the printer and placed them at the desk in my dorm room, was this: the Declaration of Independence. And I was awestruck in that. What is this nation that is declaring its independence? Independence in colonized world is given. You complain, you beg, and you ask, and you protest and all that, but there is no nation that declares its independence. So I have been in awe of our Declaration of Independence since then, and then I saw the signatures of those brave 56 men and women that signed the Declaration of Independence so proudly, their full name and their state and their counties, and it was just an awe-stricken moment in my life, and I have been in awe of those sentiments. All 1,338 words, all 18 grievances that were declared, that were the foundation of the Declaration of Independence. And I implore America to read it one more time, and you will see the wisdom of our forefathers, the wisdom and the price of that sacrifice, price of that independence that forefathers paid for us to have these liberties and these freedoms that we cherish so very much. For me, it is even why I am so passionate about this is this. I have lived twice without these liberties. I have lived when newspaper people would be shot if they published something that was not pleasing to the dictator in Pakistan. Twice in my life I have lived under martial law. I could not go and buy a bag of rice or bag of sugar without the ration card given to me. And I could not come out of the house unless the administrator will give permission for people to come out. Having lived that, to these liberties, why wouldn't I be so passionate in defense, in telling America to read these documents so we are well aware, so we can protect and preserve these liberties?
And this wonder as a young man aimed at our Declaration of Independence comes from a young man who, as a boy, would listen to your grandfather recite Rumi, Beneath the Moonlight. And that's such a powerful image to me. Which of his words stays with you to this day?
Well, so many.
So many, sure.
But, and I tell all of that in the book in great detail. But I used to sleep under moonlight, not out of fancy, but because we did not have electricity. So that was not a choice. But we made the best of those lake of resources, meaning that he would come and he would tell me stories and he would recite Rumi, whatever he could remember. And there are a couple of quotes that I write in the book. Mm-hmm. One is, this was his favorite quote, "Be a river, so what if you're thirsty yourself?"
Yeah.
"Be river for others."
That's meaning, in the book, yeah.
Meaning your generosity should not stop. Lack of resources should not be reason for you to not be generous to others. And the second that had stayed with me all of my life is that a person is not complete unless person's education is complete. And it is that quest that brought me to United States and took me all the way to the blessed halls of Harvard University, and life has continued ever since.
Keyser Khan is my guest, again, a star of the 2016 Democratic National Convention. He has a new book out, An American Family, A Memoir of Hope and Sacrifice. You mentioned coming to this country and going to Harvard. Did you ever, as a boy, in your wildest imagination, ever think you'd wind up here?
You know, I used to read these documents. First, I read the Declaration of Independence. Then I read the articles. Then I read the most important part of the document of the Constitution, our Bill of Rights. At that time, I did not have the caliber or courage or capacity to even dream. I was in such an awe. Are there people that have these guarantees, have these documents implemented? Everything made sense after I read the Declaration of Independence. The articles made the sense. That is how civilized people live. This is our rule of law. And then, of course, the Bill of Rights. So at that time, I did not have the caliber, courtesy, or dignity, or courage to dream that one day I'll be able to to go and see those people. But later on, it began to come together that I must see them. There must be some impact on their daily life, on their character of these wonderful values that are enshrined. And sure enough, even today, all this goodness that prevails in this country, the generosity, the open-mindedness, the acceptance of others that we experience every day is because of these founding documents and the values that are enshrined in these documents.
Mr. Khan, tell us about that moment. And there are a couple of different accounts of this moment in the book. When you opened the letter from Harvard telling you that you had been accepted, because obviously a life-changing moment.
Yeah. I was momentarily just in amaze, amazing high that, my God, I could only dream of being a student of at Harvard University, and all the instruction of my grandfather are about to come true. But immediately after that, the reality set in. How would I afford all this? Would I be able to even go? Would I be able to pay for that education? And then, of course, his instructions always encouraged me, that he used to say, with that, that lack of resources should not be any reason for you to not pursue your dreams.
Mm-hmm.
And it is that that brought us here. But momentarily, there was a high, and then there was a reality, the lack of resources. How would I afford it? How would it all come together?
Yeah.
And it came together.
Mr. Khan, I've got about a minute left, and I want to get to maybe, in my mind, the most important quote in the book. You write that, "I'm an American patriot not because I was born here, but because I was not." Pretty powerful.
Yes. The story of the book is really, it's a story of all immigrants. It's not only just a story. We simply are the carrier of the message, but the message is of all immigrants, that we go through to become American, we struggle to become an American. I quickly will tell you the experience that I had when I became citizen, and I want every American to read the Oath of Citizenship, so that we can defend our values. I go to the court with full realization that I have no dignities that are enshrined in documents. The oath has taken place, and I'm given a certificate which says Certificate of Citizenship. In tears in my eyes, I look at that title. To me, that means, and I'm looking at that green piece of paper, and it says to me, Certificate of Human Dignity. And I walk out with all the things that I have dreamed as a human being guaranteed to me as a citizen of this country.
Right.
So it's been an amazing journey.
Keyser Khan talks about his memoir, An American Family, A Memoir of Hope and Sacrifice, tomorrow at 7 at Unity Temple on the Plaza. For information and tickets, go to rainydaybooks.com. Mr. Khan, what a pleasure. Thank you very much for the time. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted.
It's Wednesday, which means KCUR contributor Bill Brownlee is back with this week's Local Listen. And Bill, how are you?
I'm very
nice
well,
to have
Steve.
You here.
Thank you.
You want to talk about a group that a lot of folks know about, Madison Ward and the Mama Bear.
Right. No Kansas City area group is more endearing or more charming or more quaint than Madison Ward and the Mama Bear. It's a mother and son duo of Ruth Ward and Madison Ward. And they were the feel-good story out of Kansas City, Kansas City's music scene in 2015. They released their debut album then. They went from overnight playing in open mic nights in local coffee houses to being international musical celebrities.
Let's give our listeners a sense of what Madison Ward and the Mama Bear sound like. This is their version of the Fleetwood Mac tune, Dreams.
Thunder only happens when it's raining. Players only love you when they play.
that's nice. What stands out to you about that version, Bill?
Well, Ruth Ward there, you know, she just has that plaintive voice, and you know, she captures something in the song that you know, the original version maybe didn't quite get to.
How did they first get together? Because any young man who would want to go out and perform with his mom, that says something right there, doesn't it?
Yeah, it says a lot about both of them that they were able to do that. But I think Ruth raised the kids on, you know, folk music, and it was just a natural. And Madison sings the same way. You know, he's got this, you know, old-fashioned, you know, folk bark that sounds like it's something that came out of Greenwich Village in the 60s.
Wow. How big are these guys now?
Well, in 2015, they were legitimate stars. For whatever, you know, they played all the television late night shows. They played big festivals. But they've been relatively quiet since. They haven't followed up their debut album yet.
Is some new music coming?
Aside from this song, this Fleetwood Mac cover. But yeah, they have, their manager tells me they'll release an EP in the first quarter of 2018.
So they're overdue, you're suggesting?
They're
here.
Well overdue.
I understand they're performing this weekend. Tell us about that.
They're at Yardley Hall at Johnson County Community College. It is the only headlining show by Madison Ward and the Mama Bear in the area in 2017.
And will they play with a band?
They're bringing in a few musicians to supplement their sound, so I imagine they'll play both as a duo and with additional accompanists.
That's Madison Ward and the Mama Bear performing at Yardley Hall on Saturday. This is their version we're listening to in the background here of Fleetwood Mac's Dreams. Bill, as always, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR up to date. And don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. Tomorrow, we ask the ethics professors to sort through the moral questions surrounding the accusations of sexual misconduct that continue to flood the news. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Justin Garnett. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.